Tony Zor, news director for Mount Washington Radio, and I'm joined by U.S. Representative and Major in the Army National Guard, Tulsi Gabbard, who's running for president in the Democratic primaries. Tulsi, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be here. Good morning.
Very excited to have you in the studio. I'm kind of curious, what made you decide to run for president in the first place?
As a soldier, I've been in the Army National Guard for almost 17 years, deployed twice to the Middle East, and have experienced firsthand the terribly high human cost of war and the consequences of the decisions that are made by our commander-in-chief. There are two major issues that I seek to address as commander-in-chief, bringing that experience not only personally as a soldier, but throughout the 7 years that I've been in Congress, focused serving on the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees, really understanding and having depth in our foreign policy and national security. And to serve as commander-in-chief, I'll be able to end these wasteful regime change wars that have not made us any safer, but have cost us tremendously in lives and taxpayer dollars, work to end this new Cold War and nuclear arms race, and redirect our taxpayer dollars towards actually serving the needs of people right here at home. As commander-in-chief, I can do that very directly.
That is something that you've been interviewed primarily on the foreign policy aspects.
Yes.
I'm kind of interested in the domestic aspects.
Yes.
One of the big ones that we're facing right now as a nation is the partisanship, and it's not
Absolutely.
Something that's being seen in D.C. It's also going down to the average voters. So what can you do, if anything, to help bridge that gap and bring us forward as a common nation again?
Leadership matters. You know, setting that tone and that culture of leadership coming from the White House, representing those values of respect for all Americans, integrity and honor, and truly taking seriously the oath that we take to support and uphold our Constitution, and therefore being able both to reach out to leaders in Congress from both political parties saying, hey, we've got to put country first. We're going to have differences in ideas in how we want to solve the problems that we face. But I know that if we set aside this hyperpartisanship, this us versus them mentality, and recognize that we've got to work together to serve the people of this country, we'll be able to get things done. And similarly, it's what we're doing already on the campaign, is inviting everyone, whether you voted for Hillary or Trump or Bernie or Gary Johnson, come and join us to be able to work side by side and usher in a fresh new era of leadership for our country.
Opioids hit New Hampshire and New England generally very hard. Opioid deaths in our state have skyrocketed since 2014. Do you have any thoughts on that as a particular crisis or ways
of
to address
course.
It?
It's not in the news as much as it was for a short period of time, but people's lives are still being ravaged by this crisis. Families are still being destroyed. And now in our town halls that we're having across New Hampshire every day, I'm starting to hear more and more from teachers who are seeing young kids coming in who are struggling because their parents were or are opioid addicts, and the impact that it's having on another generation of people now. We've got to do something about this and take this crisis seriously, starting with holding those responsible accountable. Everyone from big pharma like Purdue Pharma that lied and cheated their way into proliferating these drugs on our streets, to the doctors and pharmacists who are overprescribing and in some cases taking kickbacks for doing so, number one. Number two, focus on recovery, real recovery. We are not getting the kind of resources needed towards those who need help the most across New Hampshire and New England especially. We're not seeing nearly enough of those recovery beds to meet the demand that's there. And make sure that those resources don't just cover, okay, you went through the 28 days, good job. There's a long road of recovery ahead there, and we've got to come together as a community to be able to walk hand in hand with people who are working hard to get their lives back on track. You know, I opened up talking about the cost of war because it is central to every one of these challenges that we're facing here at home. I think because it's not often addressed in the news, it's not top of mind for a lot of folks, it's easy to forget that even as we sit here today, we are spending as a nation $4 billion a month in Afghanistan alone. what to speak of any of the other countries where we're continuing to pour money across the Middle East. $4 billion a month is $5.5 million per hour. So as we talk about resources needed for the opioid crisis, resources that we need for education, to protect our environment, to ensure clean water, invest in infrastructure, you can't separate these two issues. This is why I've made it a priority to make sure that we stop wasting our taxpayer dollars on these wars that don't make us any safer and instead dedicate them towards addressing the needs we have here at home. Setting those priorities with Congress is essential. You know, I could sit here and tell you, well, as president, here's what I'm going to do in the first 100 days. This is what everybody says, right? It's a total arbitrary number. I think it's a little ridiculous,
yeah.
Especially because no single president, I don't care who you are, there's not a whole lot you alone can do, except for the decisions you can make as commander-in-chief. Everything else requires you to work with Congress to get some legislation passed. So healthcare is a major issue that we need to address. Protection of our environment, undoing a lot of the damage that we've seen done in eroding those protections in the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, making sure that we're addressing the affordable housing shortage in this country. This is something, again, that doesn't get the attention that it deserves. But whether you're in small towns and rural communities or in big cities where it's very expensive to live, I've heard from people across the spectrum saying, we cannot afford the rent. We cannot afford to buy a home. How can we move forward and have the kind of security and peace of mind of building a future when you don't even know if you can keep a roof over your head? These are the kinds of things that I know are top of mind and urgently need to be addressed. And I look forward to being able to work with both parties in Congress to do so.
What sort of plans do you have for housing?
I came from serving on the city council before I was elected to Congress, coming from a state in Hawaii where the cost of living is crazy high. It's you know, rent for a two-bedroom apartment is often north of $2,000 a month. And people in Hawaii don't make a lot more than people in other parts of the country. So it's a real struggle. And serving on the city council, I got to work on issues like zoning, building partnerships between the developers and local government to, you know, say, okay, we've got land that we want to lease for maybe a dollar a year specifically for building affordable housing, bring down the price point for what the cost of developing those units would be, and create more flexibility for more rapid development. It's those kinds of partnerships in dedicating resources, federal, state, and local, looking at our zoning laws to be able to expedite the building of these units very quickly, and partnering with the private sector to be able to do so.
Now, you talked earlier about the budget and the war on terror and what a drain it has been on the U.S. national debt. Outside of that, the GAO, Government Accountability Office, a number of years ago came up with a plan for cutting just the deficit, and they pretty much cut everything in that plan, and nobody accepted it, and that was just cutting the deficit spending, not even the debt itself.
Right.
So do you see yourself as trying to address the national debt, or is that going to be a back issue like the previous administrations,
plural.
Yeah. I'm not blaming anybody.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's been something that's been going on for a long time. Some people talk about it, some people don't, but really we don't see any real change other than to see the debt and deficit continuing to increase. So no, this is a very important issue, which is why I really focus on how are we paying for the things that we need? Are we maximizing the use of taxpayer dollars that are supposed to be going towards really serving the needs of the people in our country, ensuring our national security? Real quick, you mentioned that the cost of war and the war on terror. I think it's important to make a distinction that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and terrorist groups like them still pose a threat to the United States. As president, I will be very focused on continuing to defeat that threat to make sure it does not undermine our country's national security. The problem we've seen since 9/11 especially is we've seen that war on terror being used as an excuse to go and launch regime change wars and topple dictators in other countries, which have actually made it possible for Al-Qaeda to grow stronger. So it's making those kinds of distinctions in the decisions about where and when we're using our military so that it's actually protecting our national security and being smart with our taxpayer dollars in doing so. I think we've got to look at, again, the GAO study that was done back then, do another one, look at where we are at today and examine through every federal agency what programs are working to achieve the objectives, like HUD, for example, housing, urban development. We see increases in spending, and yet we're not seeing the affordable housing shortage get any better. So let's look at it. Why is that? Why? Where are we putting our money? And if it's not working, let's put it somewhere where we're actually able to accomplish the objective, to be effective in the use of taxpayer dollars, and therefore exercising the kind of fiscal responsibility necessary to really deal with the debt and deficit. Last thought on this, I think it's dangerous for, I get concerned when I hear even some political leaders talking about endless spending. There's different economic theories coming out that say, hey, it doesn't matter how big the debt or deficit is, we can always just print more money. There are pretty serious consequences to that kind of approach that I think are not responsible in thinking about both the short and long-term negative impacts of that.
Talking about resources and allocating them successfully, green energy is a big part of your website plan. Why do you think green energy hasn't taken off in the market? I mean, if you're trying to sell sunlight or wind, that seems like something that would be fairly cheap to bring to market.
It is.
Why hasn't it taken off?
There's a lot of influence from the big fossil fuel industry to maintain the status quo. You know, they've made a lot of money off of that industry. We've, as a country, have been and are still pretty, maybe addicted is not the right, reliant. We're reliant on fossil fuels. And they stand to lose money unless they're willing to make this transition for us in the country. And I think this is where we've got to do two things, is set the priorities as a nation to begin to make this transition off of fossil fuels and towards a new green renewable energy economy. Look, there's a lot of opportunity there for the private sector to take advantage of this and to recognize that this is a win-win across the board, that we are able to do more to protect the environment, that we can be actually energy secure, that we don't have to worry about what's happening in the Middle East and how it's going to impact energy prices here at home, and it will be cheaper. There is so much innovation happening around this area of green energy, clean renewable energy. There really is nothing but opportunity. And all the statistics and studies show that it will actually end up being cheaper for us as consumers.
I know one of the things that you talked about for your website and something that's been a hot button issue in a number of states is gun rights. Mm-hmm. And you talk about both protecting the Second Amendment on the website, but then you also talk about banning so-called assault weapons, which are pretty average firearms. A lot of firearms owners own AR-15s. So where's the reconciliation between those two stances?
Well, the reconciliation, I think, is the key thing that I would focus on. I think that where we need to start when we're talking about gun safety legislation is making sure that we have, for example, a universal background check law in place that actually works. There are lots of holes in the laws that we have now, and maybe the ones that we have are not even being enforced. So looking at that basic objective of ensuring that we uphold our Second Amendment rights. My husband and I are gun owners. We understand and appreciate that, as well as seeing what we need to do as a country to try to prevent those who are seeking to do harm to others from being able to use firearms in that process. In order to be able to pass any of this kind of legislation, we have to get past how polarizing this issue has become, where on the one hand, you may have people who say there should be absolutely no legislation or safety restrictions in place whatsoever with regards to who can own a firearm. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have folks who are saying, well, we shouldn't have firearms in this country at all, and that they should repeal the Second Amendment. I think both are extremes that don't reflect where most of the country is in recognizing that we can both uphold the Second Amendment as well as try to bring about the change in our country necessary to have the peace of mind that when you take your child to school in the morning, that you don't have to worry about a school shooting, or if you go to church on Sunday, that you don't have to think about a mass shooter coming in and killing a bunch of people. Legislation will help in some of these areas, but it alone will not solve the deeper seated challenges that we face. So what I'm advocating for every single day is that reconciliation process to bring everyone's voices to the table, both those parents who have lost kids in some of these school shootings, those who are very strong Second Amendment advocates, as well as those families that we really don't get to hear from in cities like Chicago and other parts of the country who don't go a single day without someone in their neighborhood or community being killed because of gun violence. So I think this is where we've got to start, and all of the details of how we effectively accomplish that goal, we've got to work out as a country together.
One of the big controversies that seems to be emerging that nobody talks about is land use, especially when it comes to federal government, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline or the ranchers out west with their standoff. Do you have any thoughts about what the federal government's role is versus state roles in land use?
That's not an easy question to answer because, you know, you have federal land and state land, then you have places like Standing Rock in North Dakota, that's tribal reservation land. And oftentimes there's what we've seen in a situation like Keystone, like the pipeline that was built through North Dakota, the federal government overstepping boundaries and basically saying, hey, we're going to come in because this is quote unquote in the national interest, without having any respect for the local landowner, the tribal reservations, or the state's rights in that process. You know, this is something that requires all parties to come together to try to figure out how best to do this, because there are situations where the federal government has abused its power and authority in mandating something to the country that they claim is in the national interest, but really is not only violating the rights of the people whose land they're crossing, but also that argument is questionable. And I was at Standing Rock in North Dakota. And really what I saw was the treaties being violated in the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the land whose this pipeline was being built under. We saw an environmental threat with this pipeline being built directly under a water source that threatened them and those who lived in four surrounding states. And really what it came down to was there's a major corporation that was profiting off of this. So it really begs the question, is this in the national interest or is this in their corporate interests? And really what they're doing is making these decisions that undermine the well-being of not only the people in that area, but the well-being of the broader country as a whole. So this is a complex and important kind of debate to have around, you know, when is something truly in the national interest and what is the process to be able to determine that so that you don't end up having the rights of local communities and states being trampled in the process.
All right. Well, U.S. Representative and Major in the Army National Guard, Tulsi Gabbard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.